At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You gotta hand it to Henry Paulson. The guy works all weekend trying to figure out a way to save Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Makes a big announcement Sunday afternoon that the Treasury Department and the Fed are going to lend a hand. And at least for now, stops the bleeding. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Tables How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 14th of July. Great to have you here. For years, the big question about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was this. Does government-sponsored really mean government-backed? Fannie and Freddie are what are known as government-sponsored entities. They get a special line of credit from the Treasury Department and some other perks. And the assumption has always been that the government would be there for them if times got tough. Yesterday's announcement from Mr. Paulson is the exception that proves the rule about what happens when you assume. Secretary Paulson made it clear that, yes, the government will be there now that things are tough. Fannie and Freddie will get another line of credit from the Treasury, access to special loans from the Federal Reserve, and the possibility that Uncle Sam will buy company stock to shore it up if need be. Karen Shaw Petru is with the consulting firm Federal Financial Analytics in Washington, D.C. Ms. Petru, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Is this a crisis with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and I use that term advisedly, is it a stock crisis or is it an actual liquidity crisis? Do these companies have enough money to do what they do?
The companies do have enough money to do what they do. It is a stock price crisis caused by investor fear.
If that's the case, then how reassured are you and are investors by the news over the weekend that the Treasury Department and the Fed are going to help out?
One would ordinarily be pretty darn reassured by a blank check to the U.S. Treasury, but the markets still remain tumultuous.
Well, let me ask you about that blank check. We now have the authority, we the people of the United States, in the person of Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, have the authority to go out and buy shares in a company that we are lending money to in the form of a line of credit. Does that make much sense to you?
No. I don't think any of this makes sense, and nobody wants to do this. It's because we did not plan in advance. We did not regulate these firms well. The mortgage markets were poorly regulated. Everybody thought house prices could only go up. Banks haven't failed since the early 1990s, and everybody forgot they could. They had private shareholders making the money when times were good and all of us picking up the pieces when they turned bad.
Why not just drop the facade of having these things be government-sponsored and just nationalize them and be done with it?
We'd have to figure out, I think, first what to do with the shareholders who are there. In this country, we don't take private property, and that's, again, part of the contradictions inherent in private shareholders supposedly doing a public mission. I do think we're going to have round two once we get through this, as I hope we will, and stabilize Fannie and Freddie. We're going to need a really good hard look at the concept of government-sponsored enterprises and cut through those contradictions and protect the taxpayers much better than we ever have before.
Is there a little taste of the savings and loan crisis of the 80s and 90s in here?
There's a lot of taste of that, because then the taxpayers also picked up the bill for a lot of poor decisions. One of the identical factors between the SNLs in the 80s and Fannie and Freddie today is lack of capital. Shareholders had nothing to risk in the SNLs because they didn't have much capital at stake. So there was a heads I win, tails you lose bet. And that was similar because of the poor regulation of the GSEs.
Do you have fears about the rest of the financial sector, some of the banks?
No, I do think we will see some more bank failures. I think we've, again, been through a period of poor regulation and complacent investors, and to solve that problem is going to hurt.
Karen Shaw Petru is the managing partner of Federal Financial Analytics in Washington, D.C. Ms. Petru, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I asked Ms. Petru about other banks and the rest of the financial sector because bank earnings start coming out this week. But Wall Street wasn't waiting around for the actual bad news to hit. Cleveland-based National City dropped 15% today. In fact, trading was stopped at one point. Washington Mutual traded down more than 30%, enough so that the bank was forced to make an announcement after the bell that it's got plenty of money in the bank to meet its obligations. Nobody expected bank profits to be especially good, but are they really going to be that bad? We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out.
The funny part is, the only real surprise there could be in bank second quarter earnings is if they turn out to be really good. Sean Ryan is an analyst with Stern AG.
Everybody's assuming that actual reported earnings per share will be weak, but nobody really cares. All that anybody really cares about looking at in these earnings reports is indicators of credit quality and indicators of capital adequacy.
He says the problem is banks have been in a vicious cycle for the last couple of months. They need to raise capital, so they sell more stock, which dilutes the share price and pushes the stock even lower. He expects some banks will go under the way IndyMac did last week. He says those failures could happen through the end of this year and even into next. Gerard Cassidy is an equity analyst at RBC Capital Markets. He says banks and their shareholders are definitely in for a rough ride.
It is going to be painful, which is what's happening on days like today. It's going to take time, and it's going to take perseverance. But in the long run, the system is resilient, and the system will get through this.
But Cassidy says that even banks that manage to make it through this round may not survive. He expects a lot of them to get bought up.
Once investors and bank managements have a good feel that the worst is over on the credit front, we anticipate there will be a number of transactions done.
Cassidy says that consolidation probably won't start until 2010 or 2011. In the meantime, he expects bank earnings to be down as much as 35%. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Securities and Exchange Commission was working this weekend, too. Yesterday, the SEC announced a crackdown on the spread of false rumors. True rumors are okay, I guess. But regulators are worried about gossip that threatens financial stability, like the reports at the end of last week that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were running short on capital. Marketplace's John Dimsdale points out that limiting rumors in a place like Wall Street isn't so easy.
The Securities and Exchange Commission today stepped up its review of the rules that stockbrokers are required to have to prevent the deliberate spread of wrong information to manipulate markets. SEC Chairman Christopher Cox says rumor mongering is a particular problem in a fast-moving market like this one.
For several months, going back to March and the very rapid demise of Bear Stearns, the SEC has been enforcing and investigating the manufacture of false information for the purpose of profiting and manipulating securities prices.
Banks right now are vulnerable to rumors they don't have enough capital to meet their obligations. Short sellers who bet that a stock will go down are accused of spreading false reports of financial trouble to cash in on falling prices.
Rumors have been a problem on Wall Street for 200 years, or basically as old as Wall Street's been a financial center.
Richard Silla is a financial historian at NYU.
We call them stock and bond markets, but really they're information markets, in which way interest rates are going to go, how well's the economy doing. I think it's very easy to, you know, crack down too hard on speculators or rumor mongers, you know, and then destroy the information that is the lifeblood of the market.
SEC Chairman Cox says the new enforcement action cracks down only on rumors the disseminator knows to be false. He says stock traders, whether short or long, will still have full access to accurate information. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Hey, so don't tell anybody, but Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac shares actually rose today, that after a rough start. The same did not apply, though, to the major indices. That was gossip, get it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's what happened in the global oil market today. Not too darn much. Crude rose a dime to just over $145 a barrel, mostly because we didn't hear much from or about Iran. We're going to take some time this week and look past prices in the oil market and try to understand why they move the way they do. Iran is the world's number four oil exporter, so we've called George Jaffe at the University of Cambridge to get some insight. Professor Jaffe, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
How important is oil to the Iranian economy?
Oh, it's absolutely vital. Oil exports form 97% of Iran's total export revenues. To that extent, the Iranian government is utterly dependent on what it can export.
The other economic story with Iran, of course, is international sanctions and economic barriers to trade there. Does that contribute to their feelings of insecurity and then make them lean on oil at all?
It certainly makes them feel much less secure. And despite the bombast with which they respond to the introduction of sanctions, they know how effective they can be. Iran's major bank, Bank Melli, is now under sanction by the European Union. And only a few days ago, Total, a major French oil company, announced that it was not going to pursue a gas contract in the Persian Gulf. Now, those sorts of things, although Iran can live with them, certainly cause perturbations in the economy, and they're bound to increase Iran's sense of insecurity, that sense that it is going to be attacked and that it's a target for the hostility not just of the United States but of European states as well.
The issue of oil as a matter of national security, not in terms of the external appearances but internal peace of mind, just doesn't seem to be there.
No, I don't think it is in the same way. I don't think they make that kind of distinction. For them, their external activities are of a piece. They all reflect in some way the power of the state, its ability to talk to other states on an equal footing, and to be taken seriously by other states. Now, the problem for Iran has been that the United States doesn't take it seriously. It hasn't done so since the hostage crisis. And that, therefore, the hostility shown by the United States towards Iran is returned in kind. There's another consideration, too. The United States has not taken oil from Iran ever since the Reagan administration, simply because at that time it was embargoed, and the embargo has remained in force ever since. And that, of course, means that the Iranians feel even less willingness to compromise with the United States because they can see no benefit in doing so.
It's not like oil is going to get cheaper anytime soon. And I'm wondering what your take is on how that will affect the international geopolitical situation as it regards Iran.
My response, I think, would be, first of all, to say, what actually does one mean by saying that oil is not going to get cheaper anytime soon? In nominal terms, of course, you're right. But you need to remember that the dollar has declined in value. That means that for a country like Iran, the real purchasing power of the oil it sells is really no more than $70 a barrel. That isn't very great. And that is one of the reasons why it, together with other OPEC members, is very reluctant to see any reduction in the nominal value of oil to avoid declines in the real value of the revenues they receive. That means that these prices will remain high, there's no doubt about it. But again, what we're actually seeing is a change in the nature of the global oil market. The geopolitics of oil are going to much more focus on a multipolar and not a unipolar world. And that has implications too for America's view of itself and of its role inside the wider world. It's going to be a much more difficult world inside which to operate, simply because of the question of oil.
George Jaffe at the Center for International Studies at the University of Cambridge in England. Professor Jaffe, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
We get details tomorrow about the long, hard summer retailers have been having. The Commerce Department set to release June numbers in the morning. But we don't need statisticians to tell us that slower consumer spending is hurting everybody. And luxury retailers are finally feeling the pinch because shoppers just aren't so eager to shell out for that $300 Dolce & Gabbana blouse. But that doesn't mean they're not going to buy it. Stacey Vanek Smith reports that these days the devil wears discount.
Outlet mall shopping used to be nothing short of a blood sport. Products wrestled from the arms of the weak, fights erupting over scuffed Prada pumps from 3 years ago, and shoppers desperate to find their very own brand name buried treasure. That's far from the scene at the Desert Hills Premium Outlet Mall outside of Palm Springs. At Saks Fifth Avenue's Off Fifth Outlet store, designer jeans are fanned tastefully on a table, soft music plays, and salespeople ask you if you need anything. Rob Wallstrom is the president of Saks Off Fifth. He says this year the company hung up its clearance center image.
We really developed a modern luxury loft environment. We grew our fine jewelry department, you know, great denim department with premium denim. We put almost twice as many salespeople in the store.
Wallstrom says Saks will open three more outlet stores this year. As shoppers trade boutiques for bargains, outlet is in. Coach, Cole Haan, Juicy Couture, and just about every fancy brand is investing in high-end outlets. Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst with research firm NPD Group.
So much of the upper middle class has entered into the luxury market that is now not participating as much. The consumer who aspires and trades up is now not trading up as often.
But people are buying luxury goods in the newly luxurious outlet malls. At Coach, sales dropped 1% last winter at the full-price stores, but they were up more than 17% at factory outlets. Nordstrom sales fell 11% in the spring, but sales at Nordstrom Rack stores grew. Cohen says prices on the clothes may be going down, but the margins are going up for manufacturers like Donna Karan and Ralph Lauren.
The fact that they have that upper end of the market, that's the aspirational piece. So even when they open up in outlet centers, the volume-oriented part of the business is done to make money, while the couture part of the business is meant to really keep the image alive.
But the distance between the two is shrinking. The lower end has moved up, and it comes with a bigger price tag. Saks's Rob Wallstrom says today's shoppers are happy to give up the fancier stores, but they don't want to give up that shopping experience entirely.
We've been looking for more luxury brands, and in some cases they might be more luxurious than brands we've carried in the past, so some prices may have gone up, but we find the best-selling brands for us are our most luxurious brands.
But the newly upscale outlets don't suit everybody. School teachers Megan High and Kim Jones have hit the Desert Hills Mall in search of the more traditional outlet experience.
Are you guys finding good deals out here?
Not so much.
No, not really.
I don't think the prices are that much less than normal stores.
Case in point. At the Coach outlet, the last year's wallets in the clearance bin were still going for $180, a price that will, no doubt, have some shoppers heading back to the trenches. In Cabazon, California, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, the sticky side of nanotechnology.
Okay, but that sounds like tape, but it's not. What is making that sound?
You're hearing millions and millions of these nano hairs rubbing against each other and vibrating.
But first, let's do the numbers. Fannie and Freddie held up, but financial stocks continued to hemorrhage today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials moved down 0.4%, 45 points. Closed at 11,055. The NASDAQ dropped 1.1%, 26 points, finished at 2212. The S&P 500 declined 0.9%, 11 points, ended the day at 1228. Bank stocks were the big casualties of the day. Washington Mutual, as I mentioned, plummeted almost 35% after Lehman Brothers said the nation's largest savings and loan may report $26 billion in losses this year. M&T Bank and Wachovia each lost about 15%. The high-tech I love you, I hate you drama between Yahoo and Microsoft continued again. Shares in Yahoo staggered down 4.25% after the search engine giant rebuffed Microsoft's latest overture over the weekend. Microsoft traded down 0.4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies about the economy before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. The Commerce Department reports on business inventories for May. And players step up to bat at Yankee Stadium for baseball's All-Star Game. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Chances are we wouldn't be dealing with the problems at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were it not for those three little letters we've been talking about today, G, S, and E, government-sponsored enterprise. Fannie and Freddie have a curious hybrid relationship with the federal government. It's helped more Americans own homes, sure, but it's also why taxpayers might eventually be on the hook for billions in their losses. Commentator Amity Schles says the solution is completely clear.
Hybrids sound nice, hybrid vans, but hybrid companies are inherently unstable, especially companies that are a mixture of public and private. Because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were hybrids, Washington didn't oversee their every move. Because Fan and Fred were hybrids, they did things that a private company wouldn't. Take pay packages to a new extreme, invest peculiarly, expand egregiously. Privatizing the pair now is what some conservatives are talking about. And privatization would have been a good move. 18 months ago, it's awfully costly to assume all the obligations that Fan and Fred have now with their shares plummeting. So privatization in the classic sense probably won't happen. Lawmakers will more likely continue what they did before. Crisis management of the hybrid. Periodic intervention. They'll throw billions at Fan and Fred now, and they'll throw more billions later. The better move is to nationalize Fan and Fred. Okay, it's conservative heresy to say it. But Britain nationalized Northern Rock. Our own FDIC nationalized Continental Illinois, one of the nation's biggest financial institutions back in the 80s. That worked so well, few people even remember it. If Congress owns Fan and Fred outright, it has to take responsibility for them. Lawmakers can cut out the bad parts of the companies and write down the bad news. The taxpayer will have to pay for that. But taxpayers would have had to pay anyhow, either when they get the bill for the next intervention or sooner. A Congress that owns Fan and Fred can also do good. It can isolate the healthy parts and make them freestanding companies. Then some privatization would be possible. In other words, a Congress that owns Fan and Fred can get us all to closure on this dark story. Nationalization isn't the best idea in the world, but it is better than pretend privatization. The worst option of all is the likeliest. Fannie and Freddie remain hybrids. Then it's only a matter of time before they crash and take the rest of us with them.
Amity Schles is a columnist for Bloomberg and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her most recent book is called The Forgotten Man. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says Contact. Sometimes the best new ideas aren't so much discovered as they are found, sitting right there in plain sight if we just look a little harder. Scientists have picked up on that, and they've used what they found in nature to bring us countless new products. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin has this story of a collaboration that aims to get us all into a sticky situation.
The little green gecko in the Geico commercials, quite the car insurance salesman. But scientist Robert Full says real geckos are much more impressive. We're in his lab at the University of California at Berkeley. Full takes a foot-long gecko out of its cage. I gasp. So does the gecko.
Why is his mouth open like that?
So they make this this barking noise.
Big mouth, unblinking eyes. I'm already impressed by this lizard. But Dr. Full wants me to check out its toes.
These toes actually uncurl and peel, much like this party favor that when you blow it sort of comes out and peels back. And their toes do that in milliseconds.
Billions of microscopic hairs on gecko toes let them stick like crazy glue to walls and ceilings. But unlike glue, these critters can peel off at will. Wet, dry, rough, or smooth surface, all the same to the stickable gecko. No man-made adhesive could match the gecko's grip and easy release. Imagine the commercial applications. Professor Full and Berkeley roboticist Ron Fearing have. They created a reusable adhesive that mimics the gecko's toes. Fearing says it could be used for everything from backless high heels to baseball gloves to surgery where doctors need to hang on to slippery tissue. Fearing demonstrates how his adhesive sticks when it slides along a glass panel, just like a gecko would.
Okay, but that sounds like tape, but it's not. What is making that sound?
You're hearing millions and millions of these nano hairs rubbing against each other and vibrating. So you're hearing the sound of, literally hearing the sound of nanotechnology.
Can you do it again?
What makes gecko tape so attractive to so many industries is that, just like the lizard, it's self-cleaning. Fearing uses his robots as an example. Imagine one climbing a wall with duct tape on its feet. The robot would be good for a couple of steps, and that's it.
The gecko doesn't have that problem. It's got this amazing ability. It'll walk through dirt, and about half a dozen steps, the dirt will come off, and it'll be sticking again just about as good as new.
The UC Berkeley team's work has attracted the attention of dozens of companies that are in the market for sticky stuff. Baseball glove makers, fashion designers who dream of shoes with no tops, surgeons who need to hang on to slippery tissue. David Edwards is chief technology officer at Avery Dennison, the company that makes price tags and labels. Edwards says now the company wants to create new products using gecko adhesive.
We could imagine it being used in wound care systems, so Band-Aids, where it would be very, very easy to peel off the skin, almost ouchless.
Edwards has made some gecko tape prototypes from plastic. That's relatively easy to do in a lab, but mass production's a lot harder.
There are billions of these filaments in every square inch of tape you make. So finding a way to do that very, very quickly, of course, can't take all day to do it. It's no good making a label once a day, is really the challenge.
And it'll cost millions in research and development. So it's back to the lab for now. Edwards hopes to have the tape on the market in 3 years. Meanwhile, Avery Dennison's competitors are working just as hard to put gecko tape on store shelves. In Berkeley, California, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, in which the phrase caveat emptor, buyer beware, comes to mind. A federal judge ruled today that online auctioneers like eBay are not responsible when fake brand name goods are peddled on their sites. Tiffany had sued over some bogus jewelry sales the company said infringed on its trademark. eBay is not completely out of the legal woods, though. Last month, a French judge awarded the luxury goods dealer LVMH $61 million in basically the same kind of case. eBay does have that one on appeal. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 45 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ tripped down 26 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 11 points. That is 0.9%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, the shadier side of baseball ticket sales.
If you sell me your extra tickets that I buy, is that illegal? I don't think so. I paid the cash, right?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.